Shall I begin, Your Honor?
Please.
Okay. This is a case with many layers, and I'm going to begin with what we regard as the bottom, a fundamental layer, and that is our motion for specific performance in this case.
And you're still Myra's son.
I'm still Myra's son. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I've been thinking a lot about this case. Myra's son, appearing for Mr. Avery. I begin with the interpretation of the plea agreement. In the section marked, headed, what the government agrees to do, the government said it would not prosecute Mr. Avery so long as he did not breach the plea agreement. It says that he breached because he sought 2255 relief based on a ground that he did not preserve from waiver in the plea agreement. And I want to just talk a little bit about what this plea agreement actually said. It said he wouldn't be prosecuted as long as he made a guilty plea to honest services fraud, and that involved, in this case, admitting a breach of his fiduciary duty, self-dealing, self-profiting, and having this conflict of interest with the interests of the trust. The plea agreement is silent on whether he has to admit money property fraud based on false or fraudulent statements or misrepresentations. Silent on that point. He has to agree not to do a direct appeal, and he didn't do a direct appeal. And as I said, there are certain waivers that he made to a 2255 petition. And the government interprets that as meaning if he comes in and says, the conduct I admitted does not, in fact, constitute honest services fraud, that that's a breach. It's pretty fundamental, respectfully, to collateral attack in this case, that a defendant has to have the right to come in and say, my conduct, which I admitted and I don't repudiate, does not constitute the crime of my conviction. That meant that my confinement is unlawful.
Well, I'm with you so far.
Okay.
And I agree that filing a 2255 is not in and of itself, obviously, a breach of the agreement. And we have the unusual case here where the underlying law shifts. But what I think I'd like you to zero in on is when the individual recants the actual statements as in terms of admissions that were made in the plea, as opposed to the larger legal question, which is challenged on the 2255.
And I think that Your Honor is referring to the very lengthy affidavit that Mr. Avery lodged under seal with his original petition.
Correct.
And there are two responses to that. The critical thing he had to admit and that he did not repudiate was that he had a conflict of interest with the trust, that is, this loan was guaranteed by trust assets, and he didn't arrange to repay it. There was supposed to be a repayment agreement drafted, and he didn't do that. He never said, I did that. He didn't repudiate that he failed the trust in that regard. Remember that he had to, that we now know that honest services fraud has as its core the admission of taking of a kickback or a bribe. And there are sort of these hints in the information in this case that the project to do a charter aircraft service was meant to benefit the trustees. I think that that's sort of the tenor of the information. And what he did say, and that's okay because he's saying this didn't make me innocent, is I didn't take any kickbacks. I didn't take any bribes. I didn't give any kickbacks. I didn't give any bribes.
Can I ask you, and I know we are walking a fine line here because there are some sealed documents. What about statements regarding the mortgage?
The mortgage, well, I think that what this brings in, I think, Mr. Kane and my client's contact with Mr. Kane in terms of operating the charter service and beginning the project itself. And the response is that this to me is part of admitting an intentional deception of the trust. And he said that it wasn't an intentional deception of the trust, but as I say, in the plea agreement, he wasn't asked to admit, and he didn't repudiate admissions in the plea agreement.
But didn't he?
In other words, I'm sorry.
Didn't he say in the plea agreement that he used the $52 million to obtain a loan for $304,000, and then in his 2255, he said, I have no idea what that money was for?
What I think he said in the 2255 is, I understood that I was supposed to clear my debts, and this was part of this whole project. And then there's a context to this trust instrument and to the ability of the trustees to be paid by the trust for their services. And it was kind of a strange trust, but it sounds as though these trustees could take fees, and including, I think in the case of the mortgage, fees in advance or fees that went against future trustee fees. So I don't believe that that was a repudiation of the plea agreement in the sense of saying I didn't, the government says the way that he repudiated the plea agreement was that he asserted factual innocence under both possible theories of fraud, honest services and intentional deception. To say that I used the money to pay the mortgages is not to say I committed intentional deception. It's just another piece of his breach of trust and self-dealing.
But what if he then recants that fundamental principle about what this money was, this $300,000 was? I mean,
think you could.
So how do you reconcile that? I mean, I really think
I would reconcile it this way, Your Honor. This was a trust that was, it was strange. It wasn't like other trusts. It was a strange trust, okay? And it seems to me that what these trustees did over the years was they accounted, that first of all, the trustor was very, very well cared for until the day she died. So that piece of what that in purposes of the trust was, that purpose was carried out. The management of the trust, the structure, allowed the trustees to make many decisions as the officers of Avenco, this company that held the trust assets. And it seems to me that there was something of a pattern with respect to these trustees. They could take advances against their fees, and that would be a form of self-dealing. And in this case, what we had was a situation where if you stepped too far in terms of the self-dealing, at some point it was going to be a breach of your fiduciary duty. And I don't think, the bottom line is that even in his affidavit, Mr. Avery never repudiated that he stepped over that line. And that's the thing that he would have had to repudiate and without the protection of Skilling for him to breach the agreement.
The line?
I'm sorry?
Does your client get to define the line?
I believe.
The government says he stepped.
I believe that Skilling sort of sets the line, and I think that my client's conduct is conduct that falls into that category of conflict of interest and self-dealing that's set by Skilling, that's said to not be honest services fraud. And that's what he...
Wasn't his theory in bringing the 2255 that he pled guilty to a crime that no longer exists?
It was conduct that did not constitute a crime. His amended petition made that very clear, and that's what we're saying he did. The government agrees, I think, in their brief, that if that is what he did, then he may not have breached the agreement. So,
did he tell the government after achieving success on the 2255, that he was ready to proceed with a revised version of the plea agreement?
He didn't, that I know of, and I don't know that I think the plea agreement obligated him to do that, Your Honor.
So is it your view that he could repudiate certain things as long as they weren't fundamental to the plea agreement at the outset?
The plea agreement set out what he had to admit, and in our view, he didn't essentially repudiate the things that he admitted. It's just that those things were not a crime. That is our position. And I just quickly want to talk about how, because he didn't breach, the government has basically what constitutes a rescission clause. And I just wanted to make two comments about that. First, the interests at stake in the plea negotiation process are to achieve justice, whatever that term means, and finality, importantly for the defendant as well as for the government, with less use of resources. And if you allow rescission, especially in a case like this, because what we're saying is that he admitted conduct that doesn't, in fact, constitute honest services fraud, the government now wants to get a second bite at the apple under the different theory of intentional deception. And they think that their rescission provision should permit that. And as just as a policy matter, the way we used to say in law school about public policy and contract provisions, that should not be allowed because of these interests that are at stake in plea negotiation. And also, this plea agreement didn't expressly say, look, there's these two theories of fraud, and you're admitting honest services fraud. But if for some reason your conviction is vacated, whatever verb you want to use, because you're not guilty of honest services fraud, we get to come after you for intentional deception. It seems to me that if that's what the government means, it better say that in a plea agreement, and because they're the drafter of the agreement, these terms are vague and should not be interpreted against my client. I have 2 minutes now. I quickly want to talk a little bit about the statute of limitations motion, which is the other a dispositive motion that my client filed. We know that the law is that if the second charging instrument is substantially the same, it will relate back to the first. So what we have here is the information, and we have the indictment. And the government is relying very heavily on the Ninth Circuit's decision in Avery, the original decision in Avery, that sent the case back to the district court. And we don't think that the language in that decision, and we set it out in the brief, tells us that this is a definite decision that that panel made, that the indictment would relate back. They didn't even have an indictment in front of them at that time. There are two ways to look at this very quickly. One is the text of the charging instruments, and this is an information that alleged a scheme and artifice to defraud. In one place it said, to defraud of money and property and the intangible rights to honest services. This would be at excerpt of record 184 to 186. And that's consistent with a charging a violation of 1346, because all 1346 says is a scheme to defraud can be one to deprive of honest services. And, of course, only one in the information, only one had to be proven. And strikingly, the information never says, and I would challenge the court to look at the text of that information and find where it is said that my client made a false misrepresentation, a false representation or omission to anyone. What it says is there are many things he didn't do to protect the trust, but it doesn't say that he lied or failed to tell somebody something important. Then when they talk about the acts in execution of the scheme, they talk about deprivation of honest services as a means to obtain money and property by means of depriving the trusts of their right to honest services. And that's important. We talk a little bit about means and how those are connected very closely, and I've run out of time.
Thank you.
Your Honor. If I could still have a minute or two
for
rebuttal.
I will give
Thanks.
You a minute for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, James Pierce of the United States. Defendant Mark Avery defrauded a trust out of more than $50 million, funds that he lavished on himself and his friends. The district court correctly concluded that he was subject to prosecution and that the prosecution was neither time-barred nor vindictive. The resulting convictions are sound and should be affirmed. Now, turning first to the plea agreement issue, there are two independent grounds on which Defendant Avery's claim falters, and one I didn't hear my friend on this other side address at all, which is that unlike the plea agreements at issue in the Barron or Transfiguracion cases, the language in this plea agreement was both broad and unambiguously clear that under the circumstances in this case, Defendant Avery was subject to re-prosecution. And that language reads that if the guilty plea is a number of verbs vacated, set aside, withdrawn, rejected, etc., or the sentence is vacated, set aside, modified, at any time in any proceeding for any reason, then the government would be free to prosecute the defendant, Mr. Avery, for any charges arising out of the investigation for which there is probable cause. That's the end of the inquiry.
Your argument is that claimed withdrawal of admissions is irrelevant if you look at that prong of the plea agreement.
Of that language. That's precisely our argument. And that language shows up twice. First at excerpt of records 175 when it talks about the defendant's waiver, and then again on the following page at 176 where it's what the United States agrees to do. The first sentence my friend quoted, which says the United States agrees in exchange for the defendant's guilty plea not to further prosecute the defendant. The following sentence, though, is the one that I just quoted with the important transitional provided, however. In other words, it's an exception to the agreement that says in the instance that there is the vacatur of either the guilty plea or the sentence at any time in any proceeding for any reason, then the defendant is subject or the government is free to re-prosecute for any charges for which there is probable cause. There is no ambiguity in that language. I read my friend's argument in the reply brief to be, oh, there's some ambiguity because the first sentence sets out the exchange, but that language has to be read in context of the very clear second sentence providing that exception, and again, that exception is language that is quoted not only there, but in the preceding page of the plea agreement setting out the defendant's obligations. If that argument stands alone as to why re-prosecution here was satisfactory. The court need not weigh into and determine whether there was in fact a breach of the plea agreement or not. Now, of course, we think that there is. The district court so concluded, and we rest that argument on two independent grounds. One, there was quite a bit of discussion about, which is, did Mr. Avery, in his lengthy 140-page affidavit, recant his factual guilt? The answer to that is yes. The court has already alluded to one piece of that, this mention of the mortgage. I won't say more about that because of the sealed nature. But there are a number of other places. I would urge the court to look at pages 66 and 77 of that affidavit. He sets out clearly, I never lied or made misrepresentations to the trustees. And later, and I believe this is around pages 129 and page 130, the defendant says essentially, I didn't even have access to make decisions about funding. It was all this somewhat enigmatic character, Robert Commander Kane. Those are clear factual recantations of the facts that were necessary to his plea agreement. That's the first basis on which he breached his plea agreement. And the second, the one on which the district court ultimately relied, is by filing a 2255 in which he invokes an actual innocence theory. The plea agreement provided a broad waiver of collateral attack and then specified two particular exceptions, that Mr. Avery was permitted a collateral attack based on an ineffective assistance claim and based on a voluntariness of plea claim, not on an actual innocence claim. And the court's decision in Barron is not to the contrary. So that decision, which itself cites the predecessor, earlier decision in Sandoval-Lopez, talks about how as long as a defendant isn't walking away from his admitted conduct, then an actual innocence claim wouldn't be a repudiation of the guilty plea. But again, we have that repudiation here. And frankly, going back to the Sandoval-Lopez case, that actually says, look, if the government wants to enforce a collateral attack waiver, there needs to be that language in the plea agreement. There wasn't that language in Sandoval-Lopez, and in the Transfiguracion case, it wasn't a collateral attack. It was a dismissal of the information. Barron, that's not really a relevant aspect of that decision. So that ground for finding breach is also permissible. But again, now we're just on sort of the breach of plea agreement side, which this court, in our view, need not weigh into at all if it looks simply to the plain language of the plea agreement itself. I'd like to say just something on statute of limitations because my friend raised that as well. Look, as I'm sure the court has and will again, at the language of the information and the language of the indictment. They are nearly identical. And this court has said that the analysis is, are we talking about the same elements, the same offense, sort of likely the same quantum of evidence and the same sentencing exposure? Same offenses. It's true that the plea agreement referred to 1346 honest services fraud, but as this court knows, honest services fraud is itself contingent on a wire or mail fraud theory, and so it was honest services fraud in conjunction with a wire fraud theory. So what is he then charged with after his success in the earlier version? He's charged with wire fraud. Yes, it's the money and property version because Skilling takes off the table honest services without a bribe or a kickback, but those elements at the core are the same. The punishments are the same. The description of what he is charged with is the same, and that kind of gets back to the core question in a statute of limitations analysis is notice. Is the defendant on notice of what he is to defend himself against? This court in numerous decisions, I think the Sears Roebuck is an older but pretty straightforward recounting of, look, you know, even in that case there was a change of a false statement from one provision to the other, but the court acknowledged this guy's being charged with making false statements. Here, the defendant was charged with defrauding the trust and the trustees for his own benefit. And that is why the information told the statute of limitations period and made the indictment itself timely. There are a number of other arguments that he's put forward that my friend didn't address, but if the court has any questions as to any of those, I stand ready to answer them. I also am happy to yield the balance of my time to the court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You please, Kathy, put another minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. The phrase, at any time, for any reason, the way the government interprets it, would make the promise not to prosecute completely illusory, in our view. And that is not a promise that this court should enforce as part of this plea agreement. And it should not bar my client from getting specific performance. I mean, it's basically saying, we won't prosecute you except if for some reason you're not convicted of this anymore, we're going to prosecute you. That's pretty much what it says. And that is not, it doesn't matter what the reason is. But we know that it doesn't breach a plea agreement to come in and say that my admitted conduct does not constitute a crime. There are some references, and I just want to go back to in this sealed affidavit. And I just wanted to refer the court to paragraph 622 of the sealed affidavit with respect to my client's view about the mortgage. I think it bears out the view that the way this trust worked, there could be an advance, there could be use of trust money as an advance against fees. I think that that's what paragraph 622 suggests.
Thanks. The case just argued, United States versus Avery, is submitted. Thank both of you for coming to Alaska for this. And Ms. Sun, it looks like you're welcome back for the next case as well.